I want to chat with you a few minutes this morning about this intriguing subject of life in outer space, and I must warn you again, as I have done to several of my audiences during this week, that everything I say is open to your comment and open to your criticism and open to your thought process. If I am not here to sell you anything, I'm here to try to stimulate your thinking and see if I can't get you to entertain some new ideas. We, of course, are all subject to error. And one of the portions of the educational process that I think we must learn to live with and must relish is in sharing ideas and in assisting each other to better vistas of understanding. So please remember that we are having a go at it this morning with an attempt to stimulate you, not to indoctrinate you. When we think about this invasion of space, I always hark back to that amazing date of October the 4th, 1957. Because that was the day on which the Russians put Sputnik, the first artificial satellite, into orbit. And this was a tremendous event because it was a harbinger of man's movement into space. We are now, of course, in year 14 of the space age, if we date it from the launching of Sputnik. But space travel has been something that people have thought about for years and years and years before this. I dare say that from the very start, from the time when man could first look out into the sky and see the stars and discern the moving stars, which they later came to call planets, they dreamed about going into outer space. They dreamed about visits, maybe to other worlds. They dreamed about approaching other stars. They dreamed about amazing adventures out in space. But now, for the first time in history, it seems to be a possibility. We have put up many satellites, of course. We have put men around the Earth. We have made a lunar shot. We have landed man on the moon. We have made investigations there. We have brought back samples. We are planning trips to Mars. We are planning a trip to Venus. And then maybe a trip out of the solar system is within the vista of our possibilities. However, right now, if we're to make any long trips in space, we're going to have some fundamental scientific breakthroughs. We need a breakthrough in relativity theory, because the time that it takes to travel in space apparently is described by relativity theory. There has been no fundamental breakthrough in this since Einstein's description of the theory, and if we are to control that time and understand it, we need some new things there. In addition, we need a breakthrough in gravitational theory, because landing on a planet and taking off from a planet is a gravitational phenomenon. And therefore, if we could control gravity, if we had a better understanding of it than we now have, if we could manipulate it, we could employ it in our space adventures. But again, nothing new in gravitational theory has been presented to us since the time of Newton, when he described gravity with his amazing inverse square law. But thirdly, if we are to do any long-range travel in space, we need to power our space vehicles. Right now, we're doing it chemically, with liquid fuels or with solid fuels. But the trouble is, you can't carry too much fuel, because, of course, if you carry too much fuel, the weight of the ship gets too great, and you can't get it off the planet. So we need some kind of a compact, small, tremendously high-powered unit. And probably the only source of that right now, the only source of the power that we could possibly think of, would be nuclear power. There's one difficulty with nuclear power, though. It gives off deadly radiations. And this means you have to have several feet of metal, several feet of lead, for instance, between the motor and the guys that are driving the space vehicle. And this, of course, adds so much weight that is now not practical. Of course, we're using nuclear power in merchant vessels right now, and we're using nuclear power in submarines where we can stand the weight, but you can't stand the weight in a space vehicle. So some new breakthroughs are required here. We do understand nuclear power pretty well. It gives you a very compact package of energy that lasts for a long, long, long time. As I'd said to you, we have it in our submarines. It's possible now for a submarine to go down and to stay beneath the surface of the sea for, 3 or 4 years and without having to refuel. And of course, all they have to do on the new submarines now is just to come up every 4 years in order to check the engines and for the crew to re-enlist. But outside of that, this basic energy is not fundamentally available for us at the moment for our space travels. But who can know? Probably sooner than any of us dream, Science is liable to yield to our understanding the answers to these questions. And longer, more adventuresome, more strange, and more intriguing space journeys are likely to be made. Now, as I pointed out in my remarks the other evening, we have discovered at the hands of astronomy that we are in a magnificently large universe. In fact, we are one of the minor stars. Our sun, that is one of the minor stars in a gigantic galaxy. We are one of about 100 billion stars, which make up a big chunk of stars over here in our nook, our corner, our cranny of the universe. But when we look all around us, we find more and more big lumps of stars, more and more big galaxies. We see about 10 billion lumps of stars which surround us in all directions, and each of these lumps, each of these galaxies, each of these nebulae contains approximately 100 billion stars. We can see with the intricate, delicate, and excellent scientific instruments that we now have, we can see this many miles out into the universe, a one followed by 31 zeros. And in every direction in which we look, we see more and more stars. With our radio telescopes, we can hear more stars beyond what we can see. And therefore, we know this is a vast universe. What we can see right now is a one followed by about 21 zeros. That is the number of stars that we can now perceive. And I suppose the big question, the intriguing question, is, are we alone in the universe? Is there anybody out there? Is there life on other planets? Are there intelligent beings in the galaxies? And this is a tremendously intriguing question to me, and I do think we can get some guesses as to whether there might be life out there. Now, suppose you and I were having a little fun thing. We were running a little seminar, and I said, what we will do this semester, we will each attempt to bring the best information we can to bear upon making a decision as to whether there's life out in space. Now, how would you go about that? Well, let me tell you some of the things I would want to play with. First, I'd want to say to you and to myself, what do you have to have for there to be life? And I think if you think a minute, you say, well, you've got to have certain chemical elements. Right. In order for there to be life, such as you and I know, there have to be 21, perhaps 22 basic chemical elements. Carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, sulfur, all the way down to a tiny scrap of zinc and molybdenum. These 22 elements are required for life. Further, you've got to have a proper temperature. If the temperature gets too high, the very delicate and complex molecules that make up living substance will burn up, they'll disintegrate. If the temperature gets too low, the molecules cannot interact. They can't bounce against each other, the chemical reactions can't occur, and therefore life, again as we know it, is not possible. So basically, you've got to have a certain set of chemical elements, as far as we know, and then secondly, you've got to have a certain temperature range. And that temperature range is very narrow, actually. In fact, that temperature range is roughly between the freezing point and the boiling point of water. And therefore, we've got to look for places that have those elements and places that have those temperatures out in the universe. Now, obviously, the temperature is wrong on the stars. So, as far as we know, there cannot be life resembling anything we recognize as life at the moment. There cannot be life on the stars. And therefore, you and I would probably conclude that if there's life out there, it's got to be on planets. So we're stuck with another question. How many of that 1 sextillion stars, how many of those stars are likely to have planets around them? And this is a rough question. Because you see, our telescopes are not good enough to see the planets. They are dark. The stars are bright and are easy to see. But the planets are dark and are very difficult to recognize. And therefore, we've got to bank upon the speculations and the theories of the astrophysicists. So when we go to these old boys and we say, Doc, what's the chance that the stars that we see have planets around them? And they will tell us, I'll not go into any detail, but they will tell us that according to the best theories they have, probably one out of every 1,000 stars that we can observe has some sort of planetary manifestations around it, has some sort of planets moving around them. So this cuts our number from 1 followed by 21 zeros down to about 1 followed by 18 zeros as the number of stars that might have planets. Now, the next question is, once you've got planets around a star, what's the chance that one of them will be at the right distance from the star to have the proper temperature? If it's too close to the star, of course, it would be like our planet Mercury. It'll be too hot, will not sustain life. If it's too far from the star, it will be out like our planet Jupiter and will be too cold and therefore cannot sustain life. It's got to be at the right distance. And again, the answer comes back that out of those stars which probably have planets around them, again, only about one out of every 1,000 of those, again, is likely to have a planet at the right distance, so the temperature will be proper. So now the number is cut down to 1 followed by 15 zeros. That is the number of stars that we can see that could have a planet at the proper distance. Now, the size of the planet is important. If the planet is too big, the gravitational attraction pulling the matter in kind of, shall we say, vibrates it. This is a sort of a metaphor here. That isn't an actual one, but it'll give you an idea of it. The gravitational pull, the squeezing together, will heat it up, and it will burst into flame if it's too large. And therefore, the planet can't be too large because it will get too hot and, again, will not sustain life. But it can't be too small, because if the planet is too small, it won't hold an atmosphere on it. The moon is too small. That's why there's no atmosphere on the moon. All of the oxygen, nitrogen, or other gases that were around the moon have gotten away because the gravity, the gravitational attraction on the moon, isn't strong enough to hold it. And therefore, the planet can't be too big, it can't be too small. Again, when we ask about size, we get about an estimate, about 1 out of every 1,000. So this cuts our number to a number 1 followed by 12 zeros. And that's quite a few, because this is the number of stars that the best informed opinion today says are likely to have planets that are the right size, that have the right elements on them, and that are at the right distance from their stars. In other words, these are planets, the number of planets that possibly resemble planet Earth. Now, we have a more difficult question. Once you've got the right planet, you've got the right chemical elements, you've got the right temperature, what is the possibility that life will occur? And my own speculation on this is good. The possibility that life will be generated once there are the proper chemical elements, once there is the proper temperature, I think is pretty good. And then once we accede to that, if that is what we think, then we say what conditions are necessary for that beginning life, that very delicate, very fragile beginning of life that might occur on the planet, what are the possibilities that that life would develop into intelligence? And again, we don't really know. But I say there is a fair possibility that this could occur. In short, what I'm saying to you and what I'm reflecting to you as my opinion on this, which happens to be the majority opinion at the moment among astrophysicists and astrobiologists, is that there are probably a vast number of stars which have planets around them which can support life, and thus I'm not going to be surprised if there really is life of that sort. In other words, I firmly believe at the moment, on the basis of what information I can collect, that there are probably lots and lots of other civilizations. I firmly believe that we are probably not alone. Do I know? There's no way for me to know at the moment that I recognize. And yet I think the indications are in this direction. In fact, I shall be severely disappointed to discover if we are the only form of life in the portion of the universe that we can see. For I think that when we take into account the vast number of stars and the present theories of planet formation, the nature and the origin and the development of life, that I am led to believe that in a planet near some star like the sun, there exists civilization, that we are not alone in the universe. In fact, so confident are we of this that we are willing to take the risk right now. We are setting up giant broadcasting stations all over the surface of the Earth, and we're broadcasting out into the universe trying to contact other civilizations. And we've been doing this for, three or four years now. We're broadcasting on the 1420 megacycle radio emission line of hydrogen. And the message is very simple. You know, this is real interesting. Suppose this was all set up and we were ready to broadcast out into space. What would you say? Well, we're saying something very simple. Here's what we're saying. And then there's a pause of about 20 seconds, and we do it over again. And I dare say that if we get an answer back, it'll be, what's the matter with you guys? Can't you count higher than four? We don't know. We have not heard anything so far. And I suppose one of the reasons we've not heard anything so far is that the nearest star to us, Alpha Centauri, is so far away, the nearest one, mind you, is so far away that it takes 4.5 years for a radio message to get up there. So even if they pick up the phone on the first ring, it's going to be 9 years before we get an answer back. But we're having a go at it. Now, it is also possible that there are other civilizations out there that have been trying to contact us. And therefore, not only do we have these giant broadcasting outfits set up all over the surface of the Earth, we also have big ears listening. Big electronic arrangements in which we're listening to see if we can discern some kind of signals from outer space that we recognize as made up by some sort of intelligence. Well, there have been a few reports that we have suspected we have heard such things, but as of the moment, nothing has been confirmed. Well, this is all to me tremendously exciting, the possibility that there are other civilizations out there. But this is not new, not new at all. Because when I dig back into the literature of the Hebrew Christian tradition, I find that as early as the 11th century, there were Christian theologians who were saying there's life out there. Now, why'd they say it? Because they believed in a God who was creative. They believed in a God who was the Lord of life and the Lord of matter. And they said this God is so magnificent and so glorious and so wonderful that he's not going to create just one piddling little old planet like the Earth with life on it. He's going to have substations all over the place. In other words, they invoked the glory of God to say that they believe there was life all over the place in the universe, that this was a living universe, that one of the aims in the universe was for there to be life in many, many places, for there to be life where there could be life. And I have often thought that this fits uniquely in with what we have called the doctrine of the Trinity in traditional Christian theology. For one way of looking at the doctrine of the Trinity, not the only one, mind you, but one way of looking at it is to say God has made himself known to us in three ways. First, he is creative source. God creates the universe and holds it in being and sustains it. Now, when he does this, we call him God the Father. But second, God doesn't just create his universe and leave it alone. He communicates with it. He speaks to it constantly. God expresses himself, he communicates, he speaks to his universe. And when God does this, we call him God the Communicator. We call him God the Son. But thirdly, God not only creates, and we call him Father, and God not only communicates, but when he does that, we call him God the Son. But God moves in his universe. He ripples through it. He causes atoms to move and molecules to undergo motion. He energizes the universe. He brings about life. He energizes man. He brings about mind. God ripples through his universe, making matter and life and mind and intelligence and personality possible. And when God ripples through his universe to move in it, we call him God the Spirit. Now, I would say that if there is any substance to this, which I believe there to be, in all times and in all places where God reveals himself, in any place where there is life, God moves to express himself. Now, we here on this planet, especially those of us in the Christian tradition, believe that God has spoken most loudly. He has communicated most fully in that wandering, itinerant rabbi of Nazareth, known in the Hebrew as Joshua and known in the Greek as Jesus. We believe that God has focused supremely. And therefore, we speak of Jesus as being the incarnation, the enfleshment, the gathering together of God. When you look at Jesus, we generally assert we know more about God than when you look at anything else. God is more like Jesus than anything else you can think of. And we, therefore, in the Christian tradition, have said that the historical birth, life, death, and resurrection tips us off as to what is fundamental about God. But God does not communicate only in Jesus. For everywhere there is truth, our goodness, our beauty, our compassion, God is spoken. Everywhere. There is no source of truth other than God. There is no source of beauty other than God. There is no source of goodness other than God. There is no source of compassion other than God. And therefore, wherever upon this earth there is love, our compassion, our goodness, our truth, our beauty, there is God. And therefore, God has spoken to Plato. God has spoken to Aristotle and Augustine and Aquinas and Freud and Mendel and Galileo and Harvey and Newton. For wherever there is truth, God has moved. He has spoken where there is beauty. He has spoken in Michelangelo. He has spoken in de Maupassant. He has spoken in Shakespeare and in Bach and in Beethoven. He has spoken in Gandhi. He has spoken in Camus and Sartre and Kierkegaard and Nietzsche. Who spoke to Abraham? God. Who spoke to Buddha and to Confucius and to Muhammad? For God has nowhere left himself without witness. Wherever there is life, there is God. For God is that energizing spirit that is behind all truth and all beauty and all goodness and all compassion. When the Buddhist mother loves her child, there is God. When the Hindu mystic gives a scrap of bread to the starving man, there is God. Wherever there is love, truth, beauty, or goodness, God is moving. And you and I, out of having observed this strange man Jesus, and out of having recognized that all truth, beauty, goodness, and compassion comes from God, we're invited into a cosmic program. We're invited into a program that extends over the entire universe. We're invited into God's program. It is our privilege to participate in the cosmic drama and therefore to foster truth and to bring forth beauty and to manifest and maintain goodness and to see that compassion moves among men. For this is what God is up to in the universe. He is up to changing things in these terms. And therefore, since I believe, as I have expressed myself to you here, since I believe that God moves at all times in all places to manifest these glorious things among life, then I sincerely believe that I have no reason to doubt that he who became man for our planet, God who showed himself in Jesus on our planet, he could also become a Martian if there happens to be life on Mars, or he could become a Centaurian on planet number 4 around Alpha Centaurus, around that star. Of course, I don't know how God has communicated with other civilizations. I do not know whether he has entered those planets or how. But I think, in terms of the pattern that I believe to have been observed here on this planet, that God moves to enter life and make himself known and to enchant and enhance intelligence to follow after him in truth, beauty, love, and goodness wherever there is life. And we can know that this entire universe is related to that God whom we have heard supremely in Jesus. For we, I think, have been tipped off to a cosmic program. The whole universe is involved in this. We have been tipped off to something that is going on from galaxy to galaxy. For we have been told that terrifying, frightening, whispered, sweetheart-shattering secret of the way God works with and in his world. And we've been told that story in very, very simple, gutty terms, in grassroots terms, if you wish. For we've been told that story of how God functions through a message to a young teenage woman, and through a birth, and through the lesson of a life, and through a young man crucified, and through a crown of thorns lying beside a fractured stone tomb. And I speculate, I dare say, that if we've got the wit and the wisdom and the guts on this planet to keep peace for a while, if we can keep the planet together, if we can keep peace on this planet, One of these days, when we do get out in space, and we are shown by our brethren on some other planet how it was God entered their worlds, then we in turn can tell them about how God entered our world. For we will tell them a story about a man named Jesus.